You're listening to a special series of Between Two Flags for UNA Canada's Green Corps program. Through regular podcasts, Green Corps will invite a wide range of experts to discuss complex environmental, economic, and social issues. Live tweet as you listen with hashtag Between Two Flags.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another podcast of Between Two Flags. Today we are honored to have as our guest speaker Dr. Stephen Quilley. Stephen is the Director of Development at the Waterloo Institute of Complexity and Innovation, as well as an Associate Professor of the School of Environment, Resource, and Sustainability in the Department of Environment at the University of Waterloo. Trained as a sociologist, Stephen has previously lectured in environmental politics at Keele University, environmental sociology at University College Dublin, and held a research fellowship at the Economic and Social Research Council Centre for Research on Innovation and Competition in Manchester, with academic research interests ranging from the historical sociology of Norbert Elias and urban regeneration to the long-term dynamics of human ecology. Stephen has also worked on policy-related projects relating to sustainability, urban regeneration, food systems, resilience, and social ecology innovation. Currently, his work focuses on Ernest Becker's theory of ontology and motivation and the irrational drivers of environmental behavior, novel ecosystems, and the new role of environmental social scientists as navigators of the Anthropocene, and the implications of a more communitarian and place-bound form of modern society and the concept of indigenous modernity. His other current projects include the political economy and sociology of the transition network as a response to peak oil and climate change, theoretical work on energy, civilization, and social complexity, and the long-term potential of open-source fabrication systems. You can visit Dr. Quilley's blog, Navigators of the Anthropocene, to learn more about his views. Welcome to the show, Stephen. It's great to have you on.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. It's good to meet up with you again, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Yes, and just so all our participants know, we've already talked for about 20 minutes, but the microphone wasn't working very well, so we're going to have a take two, as it were, on the early part of the discussion. And I think important to know, Tom Rand, our speaker a few weeks ago, actually was born in the same year as Stephen Quilley, and has, as Stephen says, come to slightly different perspectives and conclusions on our issues and challenges moving forward in sustainability. Also, Stephen was a professor of mine at the University of Waterloo several years ago, and I can say that the students in the class found his perspectives and material really engaging and quite different from what you would find in quote-unquote mainstream media or mainstream sustainability news. So really a unique perspective. We're really excited to hear what you have to say. And on that note, I guess, Stephen, we had briefly discussed about your path and how you got interested in sustainability and the issues that we're facing moving forward. Maybe we'll just recap that a little bit briefly, and would like to have an opportunity for you just to explain your current work at the University of Waterloo.
Sure. So, path. Yeah, I'm 50 this year, so I guess that's the year when you start thinking about your path and how you came to be where you are. Mm. I grew up in a Quaker household, went to a Quaker school in Northern England. So I was always kind of in a broadly social liberal, social justice milieu, broadly speaking on the left. When I was a kid, I was doing things with CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, Third World First, and was sort of a lefty activist at university, campaigns officer, the Labour Party and for the Student Union, that kind of thing. And I ended up doing a PhD in sociology and then various positions, which you detailed. And I think I've become, you know, having kids and moving to a new country and jobs and things, I've become less of an activist, perhaps. But also more... less optimistic in some ways. I'm a bit of an Eeyore, as in the Winnie the Pooh. And I think one of the reasons I'm perhaps less optimistic than, say, Tom Rand is that I see the real wicked dilemma facing human beings being this deep-seated tension between the growth and the economy and society, this globally integrated cosmopolitan science-based civilization that we've built over the last 500 years, at great cost, it might be added, social cost, but nevertheless, at least offering the vista of social and technical progress in across a whole raft of areas of human life, and the integrity of the biosphere on the other. And I don't think that's because I hold out any, I'm not harking back to some state of harmonious balance at some point in the past. I think, you could ask questions about, an immediate question to put to any environmental activist or to get them to think about, or any writer on these matters is, where does the environmental crisis come from? What's mm-hmm. the root? Mm-hmm. And there have been all sorts of different answers to that. Lynn White famously suggested it was something to do with the Judeo-Christian tradition of domination of the environment. So an ideological religious cause. Other people have put it down to capitalism or industrialism. Mm. I think you could very plausibly argue that agriculture, the process of agrarianization from about 10,000 years ago, has really had devastating consequences. But I think I would go even further back. I think once you get an animal, a species which can use symbols and develop models of the world, what that allows that animal to do is to change its niche almost permanently, on a permanent basis, on a rolling basis, and some kind of collision between the domain of human activities and its reliance on the life support systems of the biosphere is almost inevitable. You have this tension, and it's always been there. And of course, nature is dynamic as well. So there isn't much point in trying to look for some prelapsarian kind of harmony, mm-hmm. Ecological harmony. But at the same time, it's also interesting to look at what this social development trajectory involves, because I think one of the common features throughout human development has been this tension between technology, which is part of us, it's part of human nature. That's how we use culture, we use language, we use symbols to develop prosthetic technologies which allow us to intervene in the environment, whether it's using fire or doing agriculture, digging up the soil and keeping trees at bay and creating artificial grassland ecosystems for wheat or for to graze animals on. These are technological interventions, or whether it's digging up fossil fuel and inventing steam engines. They're all forms of, they're all, part of this continuous process of technological innovation, which has a concomitant process of social transformation. Mm. So you have this capacity for technology, and then you also have the capacity for understanding the consequences of this technology and dealing with it. So what I would call navigation. Mm-hmm. And I think if you compare, I'll give you two examples, which I think are quite interesting. Early farmers using irrigation had this incredibly powerful technology which produced enormous surpluses, which allowed them to develop very complex societies with all sorts of specialists. And I'm talking about Mesopotamia, on the banks of the Euphrates and the Tigris, thousands of years ago. And yet that process of salination, irrigation caused problems of salination. And because they didn't have a scientific model of what happens when you flood, when you use flood water to irrigate, mm-hmm. They couldn't understand it. They couldn't navigate the problem. And in the end, yields plummeted and those civilizations suffered you know, local collapses. If you fast forward a few thousand years to this problem we've just had with, or had, we're still having, but with CFCs,
sure.
Because of a scientific framework which allows us to understand what that chemical is, what it does to the atmosphere, we can detect it through equipment invented by James Lovelock, amongst others, and then we're able, through certain kinds of governance interventions, to at least temporarily mitigate or resolve the problem, a very successful instance of global governance, global regulation. So the problem that we should be concerned with as activists and policymakers is the speed of change, mm-hmm. and the process of navigation, the means of navigation, the means of orientation which go with that. And I think the dilemma we're faced with now is that our technological capacities are increasing at an almost exponential rate, even in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But our capacities for navigation doesn't just depend on science, but it depends on our understanding of social processes, of culture, of psychology, of the role of ritual and religion and spirituality, a whole bunch of areas of human experience which are less amenable to sort of scientific investigation. And these are the areas where we're failing, and I think that's really the fundamental reason why technology and technological progress represents such a challenge to our long-term existence, because we solve short-term problems, but we set up incredibly intractable long-term problems, and we're not able, or we haven't been able, to develop something, you know, Aldo Leopold talked about a land ethic, but we haven't been able to generate the kind of ecological conscience formation and the kind of politics and the cultural values to go with that.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, that's that's fascinating and concerning as we enter, you know, this period. And I know for the listeners who are working on issues of climate change, I mean, the unknown unknowns are terrifying, threat, you know, quite frankly. And we're seeing new records being broken all the time. And those that would say that, you know, this renewable energy generation, I guess, or suppose, or sort of the fourth industrial revolution, as some have put it, seems to be increasing complexity to me. And I know, you know, in the class we talked about the incredible amount of energy material throughput required for, you know, basically the technological innovation and the market that we have now. How do you see that being reconciled with those who believe that we can simply build out renewable energies at a global scale to continue to grow the economy at the pace that we've been? I know you describe yourself not as very optimistic, but where do you see the next 10 or 20 years going in the sense of trying to keep things on track, as it were, even though I would posit that you would suggest we shouldn't keep things on track?
Well, I'm not even sure we'll have any say in it. I mean, to be brutally honest, I think what we're seeing now in the West, in the United States, in Europe, is the beginnings of the kind of politics you get when growth rates are declining. We're never going to see the sort of regular 3%, 4%, 5% growth rates that we had in the post-war period,
mm-hmm.
again. The social compact, which has kept class war at bay, and I think people forget just how conflictual and violent the first 50 years of the 20th century were. So that social compact, which was consolidated after the Second World War, involved Keynesian demand management,
mm-hmm.
to even out the business cycles, and public investment in welfare and roads and health services and education and all of that kind of that stuff. And that social compact depends on growth, and our relationship with the developing world also depends on growth. The global south needs development, wants development, won't be stopped from, mm-hmm. from having development where that's possible, which also means growth. So there is a real tension between growth and the biosphere, and I think my pessimism comes from the fact that the original, you know, limits to growth report, the Meadows report, the Club of Rome from 1972, which was widely critiqued during the 1970s and 1980s, largely because people couldn't accommodate it's the implications of living without growth, because the welfare, because these social democracies relied on growth, and because the global south depends on growth, so the politics wouldn't wear it, and so they were, there was a lot of criticism, and I think sustainable development is a, it was a sort of sustainable development that was a way of trying to have your cake and eat it, and to sort of bypass these supposed biophysical limits. But I think recent work by people like Turner has shown that those original projections were actually fairly apposite, and so things are looking fairly dicey over the next into the middle of this century, and I think we've only just seen the beginning of it. But having said that, I don't think that means there's nothing to play for. I think there's everything to play for. I think the real question is whether that we shouldn't get sidetracked by simply technological solutions,
right?
And by technologies. Technologies are part of the deal, but technologies which don't, there's something in economics, they call it the Jevons paradox. If you increase efficiency, people, you know, how those efficiencies get used, people end up just consuming more.
Right.
So if air flight, if you know, if planes become more fuel efficient, and you can fly further for the same amount of fuel, people, other things being equal, people will fly further. That's if you assume that that people are functioning as kind of rational, self-seeking, pleasure-seeking, self-actualizing individuals of the kind. The kind of agent who populates economic textbooks, Homo economicus. But that picture of what people are like is actually a very real picture of the kind of people, the kind of personality that is produced by consumer societies. So it's both true and untrue. It's true in the sense that modern societies produce people who look like Homo economicus. It's untrue in the sense that in an anthropological way, the kind of personalities produced by societies are very variable through history, and the real challenge for people, for Greens and for the left and for liberals, is really to try and think through, and also I think for conservatives, socially conservatives on the right, I think the left-right thing is very misleading, and we can talk about that maybe. But the real challenge is to think through what. How social and political change can produce different kinds of values, different kinds of personality types, really, a different kind of psychology, and a different kind of person. At the same time as you're using the, at the same time as you're deploying all of these clever technologies. But if you look in the faculty where you did your master's, we have hundreds of people working on technology and hundreds of people working on kind of very quite narrowly conceived areas of governance, and in that we're very typical of most environmental faculties in North America or Europe.
Sure.
There isn't, I think there's, or I don't think there's anybody working on religion or ritual or the psychology of ecological conscience formation or of how you create ideologies with traction. And I can understand why, because if you start talking about creating ideologies with traction, that's a very, you're into a very uncomfortable political space. And historically, it's been populists and people on the right who have been much more comfortable thinking about how you go about doing that. But in a way, that seems to me the problem, a more pressing problem than the technological problems.
That's fascinating, and something that I'm sure the Green Corps participants listening will take into account when they're looking at their own situations and regional realities. Just in the interest of time, I think we should move to one of the questions from the Green Corps participants, and will lead to further discussion. Max is working at the embedding project at SFU, and if I understand correctly, the embedding project, the line on the website was, you know, if think of sustainability or think of yourself as a 007 agent for sustainability, and the embedding project is Q's Lab, where they develop gadgets and tools to help other companies and individuals make their businesses more sustainable. And I might be misquoting that, but that's the gist that I got. And Max said, his question to you was, today we live in a society where much of people's lives are impacted and in part directed by wider policy regimes. However, there is trouble in the ranks and political disillusionment with political systems, business structures, etc., provoking the more industrious social change makers out there to take matters into their own hands with community programs and individual actions designed to achieve their positive aims. This considered, do you believe progress in environmental sustainability will come from policy changes or from individuals and communities taking steps to address it themselves? What are the limits to each of these courses? Thanks, Max.
It's a perfectly formulated question, and it's a very difficult one. I mean, I think I would answer it like this. I mean, in a general way, if you're involved in change, if you're an activist, then Antonio Gramsci 100 years ago had this little aphorism, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. So I think probably what you experienced in my course, Scott, was, you know, a big dose of pessimism of the intellect, and what your, you know, your audience need, the change makers, is they also need to combine that with optimism of the will. And that's a, you know, that's just a, you know, if you're in there for the long haul, you need that. In terms of individuals or policies, they both presuppose each other. I mean, I think much of the activism is framed within forms of thinking about sustainability, which are enshrined in things like, sustainable development goals, or it used to be Agenda 21, all of those kind of high level policy scenarios. But what they do is that they bring certain things into view. So the policy framework surrounding, say, University of Waterloo is very good about setting kind of minimum standards for energy in buildings,
sure.
But it takes for granted the idea that the university is part of a growing, is contributing towards a growing capitalist, you know, pretty market-based economy where success is measured by GDP and where individuals and citizenship are construed in terms of this highly individualistic, rational, sovereign individuals who either respond to incentives or they respond to education. And it completely obscures that framework, the role of ritual or of we identities or of the lived experience of community or culturally enshrined definitions of the good life, which become so deeply embedded, to use that word, that they're almost invisible.
Right.
So you need something which is the equivalent of the American dream, the idea that you'd get a job and you'd send your kids to university and they would be able to buy their own house and a house with a carport and they'd have membership of the golf club. You know, in the post-war period, that was the absolute definition of success.
Yeah.
And part of that definition of success was something like not being bound to your family. So in either in the market or the state, there's been the assumption in Western societies that when people get old, they will go into a hospital and the hospital will look after them, or an old people's home, and that it will be paid nurses, either paid by the state or from an insurance policy, who will be, if I can put it brutally, who will be wiping their bottoms and cleaning them and feeding them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that comes from an idea of the good life, which centers on autonomy.
Right,
so
right.
If you're going to change that notion of autonomy so that people, the notion of the good life becomes one in which people are responsible to each other in a much more communitarian way, then you need a much more broad-based social movement. So in terms of his specific question, how do you affect enormous change like that from within a system, a basin of attraction, if I use the language of complexity, which is very, very entrenched.
Yeah.
I think I would use the term prefigurative politics. You need forms of activism and exemplars which could operate in something the scale of a university or a community group or a form of economy, but which prefigure not just the different forms of technology, you know, car share with electric cars, but prefigure a different form of life, car share with electric cars in contexts where people are sharing not just technology, but are rediscovering the difficulties and the joys of being tied together in much broader families, extended families and communities, which come with obligations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you could in a university, if in the University of Waterloo, that we said that 50% of all the food will be grown on campus and that every single member of the community, faculty, students, everybody had to spend 150 hours a year in community gardens.
Right.
That would embed an incredibly different way of looking at what success is, what community is, what an academic career looks like. Do you hop from institution to institution chasing plaudits from outside, or is success something which comes from a long embedded commitment to a community?
Hmm. That's interesting. And that, I think that, you know, that leads into the next question very nicely from Julie-Pierre Nadeau, who is a project officer here at UNA Canada and is integral to the success of Canada Green Corps. You know, I think what you just mentioned, Julie says, and she wasn't listening, but she says you raise an interesting point about invisible energy signatures. And I think instead of energy signatures, we could just replace that with what we were just saying. And she says, do you think it is realistic and coherent for progressive left people to advocate for a greener, more sustainable world while also promoting this conception of the world as a global village and advocating for a greater redistribution of wealth, global access to education, food and health, etc.? Can globalism and localism coexist?
Well, that's the wicked dilemma, because if you go for the sort of small is beautiful,
yeah.
I mean, we should say what we mean by an energy signature. I mean, this is a concept which comes from H.T. Odum, but it's yes. heuristic, but it's a very useful one, which is just yeah. that everything, and not just physical things, but even ideas, something like the idea of human rights, carries with it an energy signature. It's only possible in certain given certain kinds of society, certain levels of complexity. And so if you want to sustain, you know, the idea of human rights only became thinkable once Captain Cook had circumnavigated the world and everyone understood the world was A, round, and two, that there were people on the world and that they were all the same all over the world. That's a kind of an Enlightenment idea, which comes from Rousseau and people,
mm-hmm.
and eventually led to the abolition of slavery, although people were fighting for their own emancipation, so I wouldn't take away from that at all. But that idea of human rights then only makes sense in a world which is integrated economically and by transport systems, and where it's kind of thinkable. So if you relapse into a very small-scale tribal society, the idea of universal human rights would probably disappear quite quickly. So does it? So you need that level of complexity, but that level of complexity brings with it a minimum throughput of energy and materials necessary to sustain that. So can you sustain an integrated cosmopolitan world, but with a much reduced volume of energy and material circulating? That depends to some extent on the technologies.
Yeah.
But it depends an awful lot on those broader kind of cultural, psychological changes. And there, I referred earlier to this kind of idea of navigation. Navigating this possible bottleneck over the next 100 or 200 years will depend, I think, much more on those cultural and psychological things than on the technology. So is it feasible? We don't know. Should we try? Absolutely, because the alternative is just too awful to imagine.
Right.
But does that mean that the left or people concerned with sustainability in the long run should really question and move away from ideas of growth? Absolutely. And one of the difficulties is that if any technology if I could suddenly 3D print, you know, the telephone on my desk,
right,
or the casing, and create a telephone which is indefinitely repairable, from a green point of view, that's fantastic, because it means that over 100 years, the energy and materials associated with that particular functionality that I should have a telephone and be connected to the world would decrease by 90% or something.
Right.
But of course, if you contract the formal economy, which is what the degrowth movement are calling for, and I think I would broadly favor some kind of degrowth, if you question growth, if you contract the formal economy, you're eliminating transactions which are visible to the state and which are taxed, and of course it's those taxes which pay for welfare and health and public transport and all kinds of things,
right,
that we need in a developed society. So there's a real tension here, because one of the things one has to do in thinking about the political economy of this is to identify how those functions, you know, if you're not going to be able to pay for childcare on a massive scale, the NDP would like to see a massive expansion in childcare in Canada. And from a feminist point of view, that's a form of social emancipation which would be absolutely marvelous. But of course, it relies on fiscal transfers from a growing economy. And it's predicated on the idea that what we need, what society needs, is more women in the labor market in a growing economy. Now, if you're not going for that, then what does it look like if you're having, I mean, you might be talking about, if you don't want to have a gender inequality creeping back in or being reconsolidated, then what does it mean? It means maybe men working less. It means a 3-day working week. It might mean something to do with universal basic income. And it might mean that expanding childcare is not the thing. Maybe the thing to do is to reduce the working week.
Right.
That childcare can take place in the context of an extended family or community, but that's a completely different conversation than you normally have in, and it's a conversation, by the way, which would overlap with a conversation you might find amongst some socially conservative people on the, you know, on the right.
Right, right.
And I think one of the most progressive things that people could do is to try and overcome the binary tensions between left and right, which have really been consolidated over the last 2 or 3 years with Brexit and the Trump election and all of that, and I actually start thinking about that. What, you know, amongst social conservatives, what might be the kind of sweet spot between a feminist position, a socially conservative position, and a green position in relation to the problem of how you look after children?
Right, right, right. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's one of the objectives of GreenCorps, and the reason why we're bringing on so many speakers is to try and, because we believe that conversation has just become so terribly polarized, and that there's not a lot of constructive conversation in the middle that are advancing constructive or durable long-term solutions to, you know, essentially making it work for 9 billion people by 2050, you know, with everyone getting fed and educated and having decent health care. So, yeah, that's really interesting. I, you know, I would...
And it's an incredibly important thing that you're doing, and I would, you know, I thoroughly endorse that. I think one of the conversations, the conversation which really isn't happening is with social conservatives. They're probably the most endangered species on campus. And I think that's to the detriment of the entire political culture, because it's only if you have those conversations that you're able to see those kind of sweet spots in these kind of wicked dilemmas, which otherwise are completely invisible. If you're, you know, the average audience, or, you know, liberal green audience, would simply articulate the need for childcare, without ever addressing what that means in terms of growth.
I mean, there's so many aspects of the education system that I would like to discuss as well, and just how, I mean, you know, where are people getting information and their world? It's so complex. But maybe we'll just have to have you back on the show in a couple of months.
well, anytime.
Yeah, and apparently, Stephen, you know, your reach is far and wide. I just got an email from Amanda with a last-minute question. Amanda Chouinard, I'm afraid I don't remember which organization she's working with off the top of my head, but Stephen Quilley was my professor in ERS last year, so huge shout-out to him, she says. I think it would be I think it would be interesting for Stephen to talk about mortality salience and the way it affects climate change and addressing the irrational instead of the rational for coming up with solution sustainability. In brackets, he should know what I'm talking about.
I do know exactly what she's talking about. I can do that in 30 seconds.
Sure, let's hear it. Yeah, because she had a follow-up question as well.
I mentioned the importance of ritual and religion and spirituality and psychology, and I sum that up in terms of non-rational drivers of behavior, and I should really say differently rational drivers of behavior. The idea that people aren't necessarily these sovereign rational individuals who respond to education or respond to incentives, and, right. and that's the kind of image of the person that most sustainability initiatives are directed at. It's either incentives or educating people about climate change, and those approaches have been completely ineffective,
right.
I would say,
right.
Over 40 years. So what Amanda's referring to is some work originally by a guy called Ernest Becker,
yeah.
who's an anthropologist and psychologist. He won the Pulitzer Prize in the early 1970s for a book called The Denial of Death. And what he argued was that the awareness of death, once you have symbols and language and you become self-aware, the awareness of death becomes and mortality becomes the overriding kind of pressing fear for human beings. And that what culture does is culture provides it provides ways of dealing with the vacuum of meaning. Human beings are meaning-seeking creatures, and what culture does is it provides socially sanctioned vehicles for people to garner self-esteem and social prestige by doing a job well. So if you're in a traditional society, being a good stonemason or being a good mother or something, mm-hmm. and you get a sort of pat on the back from society saying you're doing a good job and you're a meaningful person. And also the possibility that when you die, that's not the end of things. So either a symbolic or a literal immortality project. So it could be identifying with something that's going to live after you die.
Right.
So Manchester United, you support Manchester United, and Manchester United will carry on, and that provides you with some kind of comfort, even though, because you're psychologically projecting onto Manchester United. Or a literal immortality project, that you're a Christian, so there's an afterlife, and you'll go to heaven. And one of the things that he predicted, it's been tested under the rubric of the guise of terror management theory and social psychology. There have been hundreds of studies. And one of the things they've discovered is that everybody has a kind of death-defying hero or immortality project. Everyone's implicated in one. And in modern societies, because traditional religions, because we've killed God in inverted commas, we live in these very diverse societies in which issues of faith are relativized.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're a Catholic, you're living alongside a Muslim, and the mere existence of somebody else with a different belief system relativizes your own. And so we've fallen back on consumption has become one of the driving immortality hero projects. And one of the things they've discovered is that if you're given a death prime, there are two things that happen. One is that you become much more aggressive to people who are part of a different group and occupying a different space and a different kind of meaning project. And you become much more defensive of your own worldview.
Hmm.
And they've shown this. There's lots and lots of experimental data. And the upshot is that there was an article by Janice Dickinson I think it was in Ecology and Society in 2009, and she drew together a whole bunch of research which showed that one of the paradoxical and it really is, it's almost amusing if it wasn't so appalling, one of the paradoxical consequences of climate change discourse is essentially a death prime. You're telling people that the world is changing in a bad way, and individually and their children, there could be negative consequences. You'll be facing instability and possibly death as a result of these changes, or your children will be, or your grandchildren. And so what you do, you become much more defensive of your existing worldview and much more hostile to people of different worldviews. And this has coincided with the clash of civilizations and, the tensions between Christians and Muslims on the world stage. And also with the biggest consumption binge that we've ever seen in history since the 1980s. And one of the things she argues, and I think this is now kind of quite well supported in the literature, is that increased consumption is in part a result of climate change discourse. So you tell people the biosphere is in a bad way, and they react psychologically by going and consuming even more, which is a very difficult thing to kind of comprehend, really. Right. But it really makes sense of a lot of what we've seen. So in terms of what you do with that information, I think one obvious thing is that you take seriously the idea that people, as meaning-seeking agents, people need hero and immortality projects, and the hallmark of successful green activism in the 21st century will be whether or not Greens can create compelling hero and immortality projects which are socially inclusive and have traction amongst all sectors of the population, and which change dramatically the kind of embedded ideas of what the good life is, or what being successful is, or what being happy is, and achieve a degree of psychological traction which really gets purchase on the economy, and the economy's been out of control.
Right. And
carry on.
Well, I guess is that then Rob's transition network? I mean, I know we talked a lot about that in class, and trying to, and of course, I think most of the listeners would agree that there's incredible benefits to localizing economies and food production, and stronger ties with communities, and maybe a stronger sense of ritual or belief amongst each other. I mean, how do you, how do you stem that tide, and how do you stop the momentum and actually, get people to believe that that is a more attractive lifestyle, and to understand the benefits of that without, and is that compatible? Is that something that can grow from under what we have right now? I mean,
well, I think that will be part of this prefigurative strategy, but transition is quite interesting because it's essentially a kind of, locally based approach to, resilience, really. And it's been quite agnostic about the politics. But it seems to me, I mean, in critical mode, that one of the things that transition does is it tends to assume a lot of things which are a function of well-functioning states. So Totnes, where transition originated, is a few miles down the motorway from London, and they're busy planting, thousands of fruit trees and nut bushes and things as a contribution to a local resilient food system. But of course, if the kind of changes which they're thinking about took place, there's 20 million hungry people in Liverpool who would swarm down the road and strip those trees pretty clean pretty quickly. So if you're serious about that degree of catastrophe, then one of the things you'd need is you'd need to think about violence, because it's the state which creates relatively pacified societies, certainly in Britain and Canada, which much less success in the United States because of the gun culture. But so if that's true, then what would you do with that? I think for the transition to be more successful going into the future, I think they would have to question the liberal assumption that people are rational individuals who respond to incentives and kind of education, and they do more of the kind of the education piece of it, and try and persuade people by rational means to get involved in local change strategies, and embrace the idea that people are fundamentally driven by much deeper unconscious drives, and to explore the role of ritual and and kind of iconography and community rituals mm-hmm. and religion and spirituality in that process of change. And I think the reason this is difficult is because the people who do this, if you think about a Nazi rally, mm-hmm. when all those people are together putting their hands in the air, that's a ritual. That's a ritual process which attacks the mind through the body. The message is almost irrelevant. What's going on is that these bodies are being packed together and people are being reprogramming themselves by participating in that way to ends which are, which in the 1930s were absolutely extraordinarily calamitous and terrible. And I think, we're not a million miles away from that situation in parts of Europe today. We've seen the Golden Dawn and people in Greece. Yeah. So, but the right understands something about human nature. They understand that we are embodied and that we do have these deep-seated drives and that rituals are important. And so I suppose the question is, for transition, is how do you create a political culture which is compelling and which plays to those non-rational drivers, but still doesn't negate democracy or civil society? And for me, the key, sorry, I've been going on, but the key concept which might help is one of cognitive dissonance. Yeah. That we have to have a way to believe in science and believe in fairies at the same time, and to playfully navigate these different worlds in such a way that we can still grasp onto these scientific means of orientation, which we need them, just like we need to understand what CFCs do to the ozone layer, or what are the importance of coral reefs, or we need all of these scientific kind of worldviews, and we need them not just amongst scientists, we need them amongst the populace. So we need a population of scientifically literate citizens. Sure. But we also need citizens who believe in fairies to the extent that they are partaking in rituals which speak to our collective unconscious and to ecological conscience formation as an embodied kind of daily theatre. Yeah. And I think we'd be very uncomfortable if my faculty, we just did a thing, let's say that everybody at 1 o'clock, it was just a thing that you went out and held hands in the foyer. That for me, that should come comfortably because I come from a Quaker background and that's what they do. But Quakers don't like ritual at all. They'd find it very difficult, and they'd find it difficult mixing that kind of ritualistic affirmation of an embodied community with maybe some breaking bread. I mean, what's the transubstantiation or whatever in Catholicism, the blood and the body of Christ? Those very visceral kind of rituals with a sort of scientific worldview. And I think my challenge to my own organization is, can you do both?
Yeah.
Because if you can't, if you only do the science, then the myth-making, the meaning-making will come from elsewhere. And I think what we're seeing is that the kind of meanings which are being made are not, they're not good meanings.
They're not
good mythologies that have been dominating our psychologies. And liberals are just as responsible for that as people across the road. I think this is why we need this conversation across the left-right divide. We need conversation with social conservatives about what family means, or about what community is, or about what localism could look like.
I think, what a huge challenge. Do you still read John Michael Greer's blog?
I do, and I think he's an incredibly important person because he's doing exactly. We've had our differences actually along the way, profound differences. But I think insofar as he's talking simultaneously the language of science and the language of ritual, he's the arch druid for one of the druid organizations in the United States.
Yeah.
And I think his books. I think they're. They should be core reading. I certainly, as you know, I put them on all my reading lists.
Yeah.
I mean, I think. Have you got a website? I can.
Yeah, certainly. Well, what were you going to share?
I was going to say I have I like books. I there's a whole bunch of things that people can read, which I think speak to some of these things, and I'd be happy to work up a sort of. parsimonious kind of list.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's funny you said that. I still have the class list. I've added about 50 other books that you mentioned throughout the course onto that list. So I'll send that to you, and if you want to add, fill in the gaps, I think that would be a good start. Are there any other, and just to wrap things up, I guess, we've gone over time a little bit, but really a fascinating discussion. Is there, you know, just to kind of wrap it together in some way for the Green Corps participants, you know, if they're trying to, if we agree that we're trying to kind of soften the landing, you know, what actions, you know, what would be your general advice to the 150 youth across Canada who are working hard with their organizations to make that happen? And what actions would you, or I guess just what general advice would you have to the participants in the program?
I think the advice which I give myself, which, and the tension which I'm dealing with myself, which I think applies across the board, is to really come absorb the reality that a more embedded, greener, localized form of society would be much more communitarian and would put individual rights much more in the context of obligations, and there would be experienced as a kind of, to some extent, a loss of freedom, but it would be a loss of freedom equivalent for those of your you know, for people listening who've had a baby. It's the same kind of, you know, when you have a baby, your freedom is, you'd lose freedom immediately to do anything. You're sitting there wiping, you know, doing nappies, and if you're the mother, you know, breastfeeding or whatever, and it just goes on and on and on. But you experience that loss of freedom as a great liberation, or at least I did. And I think it's finding an equivalent of that at a social level, and a set of values and a kind of a set of mythologies which allow people to embrace what would be a loss of freedom, looking after people, caring, being involved in hospitals. And I think from a policy point of view, for those policymakers out there, I think it's worth looking at ways to reverse the process of the professionalization and the commodification, either through the market or the state, of functions which communities used to do themselves. So, right. So I would look at conscription, social service for 2 years, yeah, an annual conscription for people to every year to be working, every single person, rich or poor, to be working in their communities for a couple of weeks, to overcome the problems of liability, to allow people to get involved in barn raising and mending bridges which have been broken, for working in hospitals, and for maybe, you know, you could half the size of the police force and replace that half with with conscripted volunteers who are doing it 2 weeks a year, so that every time a policeman's out on a job, they're working with a civvy, and the civvy could be anyone. It could be their mum, it could be their irritating next door neighbour. Because I think it's the professionalisation and the commodification, and very much the liability thing. We should do a whole show on liability, because liability is killing civil society.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think unless you crack that, basically we're dead in the water. And that's really serious. I think if there was one single problem for policymakers, it's cracking the liability. And the other thing is that everyone should play the fiddle and do step dancing.
Well, have you convinced your wife to get a few goats and sheep in the yard yet?
No, she's not doing the goat or sheep, but we are doing step dancing and playing the fiddle. And I think Canada has this incredible tradition of kind of step dancing and fiddle playing and community kind of music, which stretches across, you know, there's Métis fiddle and Cree fiddle. It should be, I'm just giving a plug there for what I'm interested in, but I think there are things out there which should be garnering more support from the state and from local government and from schools. Mm-hmm. And I think often the obstacles towards doing that kind of community theater, ritualized kind of communitas, that process of bringing communities together, a lot of the time it's the liability thing. If someone wants to do something in their barn, it's the liability thing which is getting in the way. The local authority want to let people into schools, it's the liability thing, the insurance thing, which is getting in the way. So the real key, the single thing the policy policy people could do is to crack that liability nut.
Well, I mean, that's really interesting that you say that. You know, one of the organization's objectives with Green Corps was to do a whole bunch of community engagement, but of course, we've been running into liability issues. And so, you know, we're going to be writing to local newspapers. We're going to do, the Green Corps participants are encouraged to do local radio talks and things like that. But as far as going into schools and, you know, having a half hour talk about sustainability or whatever we want to present to them, you know, it's a hindrance and it's
well,
causing
can I make a suggestion, Scott, that sure. you set up, get your organization to set up a 1 day workshop and roundtable. You can record it and be the inimitable, jockey sure. on the turntables, but getting a couple of lawyers and some social innovation people from McConnell, whoever, to actually sit down and work out what a liability policy for the Anthropocene for the 21st century, which would allow communities to get back to doing stuff themselves.
Right. That's.
I mean, the state is too intrusive. If you want to, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things. You know, if you want to sell unpasteurized milk,
yeah,
or it's becoming impossible to do any of those things because the state is taking it, and that's a form of complexity which, to be quite honest, I don't think we can afford.
Who was that?
I think you have to get back to communities who are able to make decisions and take the consequences of those decisions. If people are mending a local bridge,
yeah,
and it falls down, then it's an act of God. Things do happen.
Right, sure.
I was going to say a euphemism for act of God, but I won't do it on the radio.
Yeah, fair
but
enough.
But stuff
well,
does happen.
Thank goodness we're not live. But there was in the documentary Food Inc., there was that one organic foodie farmer. I forget his name now, but, you know, they shut him down because they didn't meet, obviously, the regulations of something.
Yeah,
and, you know, he was...
It's happening all the time. Yeah, there's a woman whose name I've forgotten who has a bunch of Shropshire sheep close to my heart because that was our last point of departure in the UK, who the sheep were kind of confiscated and killed because of scare about, and the sheep were all fine.
Yeah.
But it was to do with applying a very broad brush about, I mean, I think the problem is subsidiarity. The cost of regulation.
Yeah.
Should be proportional to the size of the operation. So if you're a family outfit, there should be almost no cost to regulation. And actually, it's the opposite. The unit cost of regulation for small local businesses and food system, you know, food businesses and music and leisure businesses is extraordinary.
Sure.
For the lower down you get, but it was for Walmart for Starbucks or all those kind of people or Tim Hortons, it's zero.
It's not a level
because their operations are so big, and it should be the opposite way around.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, we have to leave it there, Stephen. thank you very much. It was really really appreciated, and I hope that the Green Corps participants will take a listen soon. If they have any follow-up questions for you, I'll be sure to pass those along to you.
Yeah, they can email me, and they can have a look at the blog site, navigatorsoftheanthropocene.com. He says, plugging it shamelessly.
Yeah.
And you can email me through the University of Waterloo website. I'm happy to respond and to engage. And thank you for having me, Scott, and thank you for letting me rant.
Yeah, not a problem.
And putting up with me.
No, it's good. And we'll also be pleased to attach that list of readings, blogs, and books along when we release the podcast. So
perfect. I should say also that if anyone's interested in doing a there's a 1 year master's program just started up in our department. And if anybody is interested in doing a master's on these kind of themes, I'd be very happy to supervise as well.
Interesting. Well, that's great. And I know a lot of the Green Corps participants.
So Amanda, if you want to come back.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be a few people that might be interested in that. All right, Stephen, have a great day. And thanks again.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.